the different patterns or libraries or like the JavaScript things, like all the things that go on in the front end world, like like which node, which tool are you using to actually just generate the front end assets? Like which one is it today? Because I fell asleep last night and it changed.
Hello and welcome to the Sourcecraft Podcast, a show where we talk with people who are passionate about developer tools and making our lives as programmers better. My name is Byung, and in this episode I talk with Evan Culver, an engineer whose team owns most of the dev tools and infrastructure at Segment. We talk about how to deploy hundreds of services, manage secrets with an open source CLI called Chamber, when to use serverless versus Kubernetes, ChatOps, and more. If you want to learn about how a company that's all about data pipelines manages a ton of services and helps their engineers be focused and productive, stay tuned. Evan Culver's career spans many years up and down the stack, from front-end to back-end to infrastructure to ops. He was an early engineer at Uber, where he worked on real-time systems and developer tools to scale the engineering organization during the hyper-growth years from 2014 to 2017. Today, he's an engineer at Segment, where his team owns most of the developer tools and infrastructure, including continuous integration, version control, cloud provisioning, secrets management, and deployment. Evan's team has a charter to empower the engineers of Segment to automate, optimize, and streamline their workflows. Evan, welcome to the podcast.
All right. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
So the company tagline is the customer data platform that makes good data accessible for all teams. Essentially, what you do is you connect all these different tools in order to make the data consistent and accessible to marketers and product managers and folks like that who want a better understanding of their users and customers. Is that about right?
Yeah, I'd say you did a pretty good job at describing it. You know, I think when people ask me what Segment does, I try to say we take data where it's produced and get it to where it's most valuable. And that could mean a lot of things, but, and that, you know, I guess that's one of our products. You could say that there are other things that go along with Segment as a platform, things like privacy. And, you know, we do things for GDPR and we do things for managing personas, but in the end, it does end up being, you know, getting your data to the highest value location, whether it's, you know, any of those destinations you mentioned, but that's it.
Awesome. That is a super valuable thing to do. So that's kind of the view of Segment from kind of the outside in, you know, as a user or customer, you know, that's kind of the black box interface that you expose, the product level description, if you will. I'd love to get your kind of overview of Segment from the inside out, like underneath the hood, from an engineer's perspective. What does Segment look like?
Yeah. Okay. So if I was to describe this to another engineer, which I guess I am right now, it's, you know, we're very microservice oriented. What that means is there are, you know, developers write Go or TypeScript, JavaScript, and those, you know, binaries or packages get produced into a Docker container, and those Docker containers run on either ECS or Kubernetes. And, you know, in general, once deployed, they speak over HTTP. And in our private VPC on AWS, we have some things running on GCP, but in general, it's mostly AWS. And yeah, I guess there's all of our application specific or segment specific containers that run. And then there's, you know, there's core infrastructure things like Kafka or a database here and there. You know, we have things like console to do service discovery, things like that. And then, yeah, I guess there's, yeah, the component of AWS. I mean, we run everything on AWS, like mostly everything on AWS, as I said. And, you know, I guess we tend to favor the AWS managed services, except for, you know, things like Kafka. We run our own Kafka. But yeah, I mean, we have run our own MySQL and, you know, MongoDB clusters in the past, but these days we tend to use the RDSs of the world or SQS or Kinesis and things like that for, you know, the things that are in our core pipeline. So
that makes a ton of sense. For the services that you run that aren't managed services, can you, you know, walk through a couple examples of some big services?
Yeah, well, the one that is, I think, the core to it all is a service called Centrifuge that basically is our core delivery mechanism. And you know, I'm going to speak above it a little bit because I don't work on it. I mean, it's really a great piece of software. It's gone through quite a few iterations, but it's really the brain of how messages make it through our pipeline, get redelivered, and basically are ensured that they make it to the destination they're supposed to make it to. So whether it's, you know, this one message then, you know, needs to get delivered three times, once to Facebook's, you know, ad platform, the other one to Mixpanel, HubSpot, it will make sure that not only that it eventually gets there, but it will be retried if it fails initially, or, you know, that it is, you know, that retry mechanism is in a, you know, a way that doesn't violate the terms of the other API provider. You know, it does it in a friendly way, I should say. And in general, yeah, it takes care of ensuring that it's delivered. And along the way, you know, it does this in a highly available distributed fashion. But this is a thing that we developed at Segment to do, you know, our core business. And so I'd say that service is, yeah, it's pretty important. It's not just one of those, I'd say, control plane services, and not that they aren't all pretty important, you know, they serve their own, you know, their own purpose. But like, for example, if Centrifuge is down, like we're hard down, you know, like we're still accepting data, but we're just definitely not delivering any data. So that said, it's actually one of our early Kubernetes adopters. So we're just getting in on this bandwagon of the Kubernetes things and all the cloud native world. And, you know, it's generally our SREs that wrote and manage this core service. And so in being at the front of it all in terms of infrastructure and the cool kids, I guess the cool things and shiny new toys. Yeah. That we're fully Kubernetes integrated there, which, yeah, the other services are usually deployed on ECS. So, but yeah, I guess that's really it.
Would it be kind of safe to say that all or maybe like the vast majority of data that flows through Segment at some point flows through Centrifuge?
That is accurate. Yeah.
To kind of use the like hourglass analogy, would it be kind of the like narrow waist of the hourglass where you have like all these integrations with data sources on one side and then like all integrations with data consumer services on the other?
Yeah, I think that's probably pretty fair. I hope I'm representing this accurately. I know Ashil, our one of the engineers that worked on this the most. I hope I'm representing it correctly, but he's really the brains behind all of it, and it's quite a fantastic situation that Centrifuge's put Segment in. And so, yeah, shout out to Ashil for delivering such a high quality piece of software.
Cool. So, you know, on the topic of microservices, this is, you know, a broad trend that you hear a lot about these days. It's definitely a buzzword. How do you ensure that the versions of all the different services stay in sync, and that you don't, when pushing an update to one, you don't make it so that, you know, it breaks being able to talk to others?
Yeah, I mean, how do we roll out code and ensure compatibility across all these different microservices, more or less? It's, you know, I think this is a challenge, but I mean, I think in general, our strategy is to have feature flags around as many things as possible and to do as much upfront integration testing in our pre-production environments as possible. So I think in general, like engineers at Segment will, you know, everybody has a pretty similar development workflow in terms of using, you know, like Docker Compose and then building things locally and just sort of, you know, their own little version of the world. But you know, like assuming, you know, you write your own tests and then you build your things and you've tested it locally, I think, you know, then it's introduced into our deployment pipeline. And, you know, that's kind of arm wavy because a lot of people do it differently. But in general, I think people, you know, stage their changes in a pre-production environment that might be specific to their team or really just our staging environment in general. And what that means is we have a bunch of QA mechanisms that are kind of ongoing where we're either shadowing production traffic or we're, you know, we have a constant workload that's being shoved into that environment, for lack of a better word. And so you basically get, you know, you get your feedback first pretty early and often as to whether or not things are actually just working. And so, you know, a lot of times we will have an incident and it's just for our staging environment because, you know, so we might have pushed some code that, you know, breaks one part of the pipeline or whatever, doesn't, you know, basically makes things undeliverable, let's say. But yeah, like those things generally get caught in stage because we have pretty much a replica and a replica that's processing very production-like data along the way. And then, you know, depending on the service, I'd say there's different feature flagging components for when it does go out to production. And so, like, for example, we have, depending on the customer and the sources and the destination, we have different ways of targeting these workloads as it flows through. So for example, you know, we have a service that will consume the messages that come off of Kafka before it gets to Centrifuge. And so there's different versions of this service that will run, and based on, you know, a flag that we set, it will roll it out to different tiers of users, so or customers or different sources, or there's a bunch of different combinations and flags you can set to make sure that this is the version that's actually going to be delivering and handling your code. So I'd say, like, in general, the easiest way to describe it is trying to deploy things dark and then light up new code paths incrementally as we go. And I think that there's a varying level of that in so many ways. I mean, there's some services, like, for example, you know, because you know that if this thing returns in, you know, 500, a Centrifuge will then retry to deliver it anyways. Or there are other ways in which that, you know, you can, there's other reliability guarantees that we have baked into the platform that, you know, if your service has failed, it will be retried. So you basically get another chance, you know, if you deploy some bad code. So
you kind of design each service to be relatively fault tolerant, such that, you know, if it doesn't get exactly what it wants, or if something goes wrong like that, it is resilient to that sort of error.
Yeah, I think in general, I think a lot of our services end up being stateless. So, you know, if there is, you know, like if it didn't do what you think it could do, it was supposed to do, that data or that request could just be retried. And so in general, that's kind of how we treat a lot of our data plane services. Control plane services are just highly available, and yeah, they're generally read heavy, I suppose. So there's some caveats, I guess, but, you know, I didn't really ever mention that we do have hundreds of services. So for me to sort of blanket some of these things, it's with a ton of asterisks. And so I hope that, yeah, I hope I'm generalizing in a way that's, you know, accurate for at least most of our services. But there are also, you know, a bunch of snowflakes, a bunch of very unique things, you know, that might be stateful instead of stateless. You know, I didn't really even cover those, but those are usually the ones that are pretty unique. So
that is a lot of services.
Oh man. I mean, at Uber, you know, this was a bigger ordeal. And I think some of my former colleagues have spoken about that quite a bit, but we're talking thousands, which was a whole nother situation. I don't think I'd be the right person to talk about the way that those things are deployed.
How do you even keep track of everything that's, you know, running in production at a given point?
Yeah. Okay. So, like, how do you keep track of all the versions, or, like, you know, if something's broken, how do we even know which one it is?
Is there like a dashboard or some sort that gives like a bird's eye view, or is it just kind of you have to rely on the people who know the ins and outs of their part of the deployment?
You know, I'd say that our deployment tool is kind of the best representative of that. I mean, depends on the component. So, like, some things get deployed with our internal tooling to, you know, to do things that are, you know, against ECS, but and then there's other things that just get deployed with Terraform, for example. So I wouldn't say there's like one comprehensive dashboard of where all of these versions exist. Actually, I say that, and I now remember there was a service that I think somebody wrote that was just called like specs, and it was just like every service in the version that I had deployed. And I don't think that's around anymore, but it's, you know, it served its purpose. But what it ends up being is just like too much information for a human to really, you know, make sense out of. And so I think what it ends up being is, you know, if you're in a big data pipeline and you have your service in the middle and maybe like five services around you, that's really the glance that you need, right? Like my service is on version 0, that one's on version 1, that one's on version 2. And that's kind of the scope of the world you care about. So I think that in that world, it's a little bit easier to manage, you know, like you really can build your own little dashboard of sorts. And I think most people, to be honest, use just like a command line tool, or they use, you know, like command, like a Terraform state sort of representation to see like which version things are on. And yeah, that's That's really it. I think that it can seem really complicated, but it ends up not being very complicated in practice. But I also don't work on every single project at Segment. So, you know, I'm sure somebody's going over and saying, like, you don't even know, I have so many services I need to keep track. It's impossible now. But, you know, there's our feature flagging tool, which we may talk a little bit about, like, how those things are managed. But those do give you, you know, some visibility into the versions that are deployed where, and also that's kind of another thing that people use to get a glimpse of all the things that are deployed. So.
So would it be safe to say that one of the principles here is that you don't want the global view of everything, because that's too much information to consume. You just kind of want to do this look around sort of thing, where you're deploying one particular service or you own that service, and you want to understand, like, what is the current state and version of the immediate surrounding services, because those are the ones that you're talking to and are talking to you.
Yeah. And I think that's probably true. And that's even if you care about the version. I guess, like, mm-hmm. caring about the version might imply that you care about people breaking backwards compatibility, for example, maybe, or,
yeah.
You know, I suppose that, yeah, maybe there's something to be said about needing to even answer that question in the first place if you build, you know, solid APIs in the first place. But yeah, I think I think you summarized it pretty well.
On the source, like the version control management side, is Segment a monorepo, or do you have many different repos for the multitude of microservices you have?
Yeah. Okay. So I'd say, well, both. Just leave it to you. We have all of it, and we have all of them. Tons of repos. I'd say most of these microservices are in their own repositories. However, we do have some parts of the stack that are what are effectively mono repos, but, you know, they produce multiple binaries. So there's a couple I can think of. So yeah.
Cool. So in this microservices architecture, one thing that has to happen is obviously the different services have to talk to one another. And in doing that, you know, different services have varying accesses, permission levels, things like that. And secret management becomes a thing. Can you talk a little bit about how Segment solves this problem of secret management?
Yeah. Okay. So we have this project called Chamber. I think that really is at the root of all of it. It's open source. I'd say it's pretty simple. I mean, it's backed by, you know, you can plug in different backends, but in general, it's we use it with an SSM backend in AWS. And
SSM backend?
It's like systems configuration backend. I don't even think SSM stands for the right SSM parameter store. What does it actually stand for? Systems manager parameter store. So like SSM, it's not SS. I don't know. I don't really know where the SS comes from, but yeah, it's systems manager parameter store. And that's really just, you know, you can store encrypted values in, you know, in a backend. It's like a key value store for encryption.
And, so, and that's the thing that Amazon AWS provides specifically for this kind of use case.
Right. I'm looking at a page that says it provides secure hierarchical storage for configuration data management and secrets management. So, yeah, I mean, it's a data store, you know, it has some things built into it that make it more friendly for, you know, encrypting things along the way. But you can do things like, you know, use Chamber to store secrets in S3 that are encrypted manually with a KMS key. So, yep. Again, KMS is the key management system.
Got it. So it can kind of hook into multiple backends.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, I'd say Chamber is at the heart of how we manage secrets. So what this means is from a developer's point of view, you will, you know, there's a command line tool, Chamber, and you'll do like a Chamber write key value. And so, you know, you might create a key manually, or you might get one from some third party provider, and then you pipe it into Chamber to write it. And then when you're actually running your program, you know, you use the other side of the tool, which is, you know, either read to get it out. But typically, like, services do this, another subcommand is chamber exec, which basically takes everything in a key space and translates it to an environment variable and then just wraps your service with those environment variables. So it makes it pretty easy to, you know, just ensure that your service is being injected with the right secrets at runtime. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So the kind of user interface would be, it's a wrapper around some binary that you're trying to execute. So it accepts environment variables and then forwards that to the binary executable that it's invoking, passing along the secrets that are relevant.
Yeah.
Is that about right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think Chamber itself only requires some AWS credentials. So okay. Those are the environment variables that it consumes. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, when it's invoked, like for example, when you run Chamber exec, it's going to go to, you know, the backend that's configured, usually SSM, mm-hmm. and then try to read for that key space all of the secrets that are there of its latest version. Mm-hmm. And then it takes those values and then populates the environment and then invokes the binary that it's wrapping. So yeah, I think that's basically the function that functionality that it provides.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that there's no real other magic that's there. Like there's other things that I think some teams use to like auto rotate their secrets and things like that. But really Chamber is kind of like the core piece that really just like interacts with, you know, the SSM backend or the S3 KMS backend or whatever. But I think there's another story to be told about how you actually then manage the versions of the secrets, which isn't necessarily what Chamber does, but in terms of just getting at the secrets, I think it does a pretty simple, good job. I think all, you know, what is it, you know, with security, it's like, you just want simple things to do one small thing, right?
Yeah. It's kind of the Unix philosophy.
There you go. I think our security people will be pretty proud.
Nice. So, you know, a really dumb question. Let's say, you know, I have an application that's deployed with Kubernetes. I have some secrets that I want to pass to the various binaries that comprise the microservices architecture. Why wouldn't I just pass those secrets directly, you know, through Kubernetes, you know, built-in secret support and ultimately, you know, as environment variables directly to the deployments? Why should I opt for something like Chamber?
You know, that's a good question. I think that, just to say up front, I think there's an open debate, especially internally at Segment, as to whether we will use the Kubernetes secrets backend. Mm. Because from what I think that there was some contention around just how they're stored and the secret of the keys that are used to encrypt it and just like how those keys are managed. Mm-hmm. But I'm not really I haven't had that conversation, but mm-hmm. I think in general, the idea is that we would want to use the secret store that's built into Kubernetes. Like why you know, go against the grain or try to insert some, you know, new functionality or new dependency when, you know, there's maybe a perfectly good solution there. So that said, if and when maybe it falls short, or maybe you want to have like, let's say, compatibility between your existing deployment environment and Kubernetes, then you might want to say, make sure that, you know, make sure your secrets are not part of the, you know, you don't have to do anything magical to make secrets work along the way or that doesn't break things.
Yeah.
So what that means, I think in practice, you know, you'd see a lot of, you know, Docker files that are written as with an entry point that's just chamber exec. And so in order to run that Docker image, you would just need some base AWS credentials. And I think if you start there, then, you know, you have a Docker image that is deployable on both Kubernetes and some other environment, right? Like as long as you're carrying along the right, or you provided the right AWS credentials that can then read that secrets namespace. So I think that might be a story for when you would not want to use Chamber, or when you would want to use Chamber across the board. But yeah, I would honestly, like for me, just personally, I would rather just, use what's built in, but, or what's goes least against the grain.
Got it. I think that's in general a good rule of thumb to have in mind.
Yeah. You know, I think this applies. I can think of a ton of different cases too, where this, you know, where it's like, just use sidecars, or like, you know, like just expose port blah, you know, it's like, I mean, no, I really want to use this over TLS and, you know, on a different port. And by the way, there's just like, maybe don't. I want to, my health endpoint's health Z, not health, just health A, B or whatever. It's like, I don't know, maybe just use the standard one. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I can think of metrics like the Kubernetes and Prometheus metric stories. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Just expose the metrics endpoint, and then you're done. So.
I feel like you see this sort of thing as a team grows. You have a proliferation of different practices and standard operating procedures that at some point becomes untenable. Mm-hmm. Before you have like a officially blessed secret management system or dependency management system, people roll their own because they need to, and then at some point you have to sit down and have that tough conversation of, okay, which one are we going to standardize on?
Yeah. I mean, it is so nice to have the Kubernetes thing be generally accepted at this point. You know, it's pretty nice to have Prometheus in there too. It's, you know, it's pretty nice that we've kind of settled on a few of these solutions. And yeah, I totally agree. Yeah. There's still going to, like, even if the community decides one thing for you, there's still going to be, yeah, like all the legacy of before that, right? Like, so whether it's, you know, I'm just thinking of all the, you know, all the different patterns or libraries or like the JavaScript things, like all the things that go on in the front end world, like, like which node, which tool are you using to actually just generate the front end assets? Like, which one is it today? Cause I fell asleep last night and it changed. You know, like, which one is it? I have no idea. Yeah. So
at some point we're just going to, it's going to come full circle and we'll all use Makefiles again. Right.
Yeah. One can only hope, you know, I was thinking about this in a broader sense because, you know, like because it changes so often and because humans are humans and we generally have like opinions and there are things that we sort of, I don't know, it's we tend towards because of our history or because it makes us think less or because it's purple versus blue, you know, it's, that's fine. I feel like we're always going to have this thing. So like, let's just let that happen. And, you know, like, but you know, like people are going to write their code and they're going to maybe use some things to help them test their code along the way. And then that's different though, when you want to actually go run your code. So like, I'm kind of been toying with this idea of like, yo, developers, yeah, do whatever you want to in your, you know, in your code repository. And then, but once you're done, you're like, the code compiles and it does a thing, you've tested it in a certain way, cool. I'm going to take that and just like run it. And I'm going to like run it and build it on the platform that you don't really have any say, you know, say to, right? Like, I'm going to give you all the resources for when it didn't do what I thought it was going to do, and then give those back to you and all the information so that you can help me fix it. But like, there's this point where, you know, when you have thousands of repositories and you have, you know, like across a time range where, you know, you might have had this one tool for this one thing and then it just never got upgraded, or you're using this CI provider and then the whole company switches to this one and then nobody changed that code base, so it never needed to get rebuilt, so it never got migrated. Or, you know, there's all these things where it's like you basically create giant migration stories for everybody by, you know, by just like forcing them to do the work, where it's like, well, like maybe we just like let them like have their own little tooling world, you know, and whatever tools they want. But then when you actually separate the problems, right, where you have a separate problem of building the code than you do from actually running the code. And I don't know. I like the idea of saying like, okay, cool. I can see that you're using a make file, so I'm going to try to run make build.
Yeah.
You know, or like, I can see that you're using a Docker compose file and now I have a list of dependencies. So now I'm going to make sure these dependencies exist or somehow like try to provision them somewhere, but maybe I won't use Docker compose.
Yeah.
Like maybe I'll, you know, I can glean the port numbers. I can glean some of the environment variables out of there, but like, that's cool. I can tell what you're using to test your thing. I can probably tell maybe how to run it in a lot of ways, which, you know, and maybe it's incomplete, but then maybe let's start there and then we can plug some holes. But if, you know, I just like the idea of like letting developers sort of like choose their own destiny when it comes to how they want to build their code and like let the small teams kind of be autonomous in as much of a way as possible. But then, you know, it gets a little dicey when all those things come in and say like, well, your platform that's running our code or building it, it needs to have dependency X, Y, and Z because mine has it. And it's like, well, you know, like maybe that thing is harmful, or maybe that thing is, you know, yesterday's JavaScript tool and we're trying to use today's JavaScript tool, you know, or something, right? Like maybe it's, you know, or maybe it's like, hey, by the way, that thing has like super bad vulnerabilities baked into it. And we know that, you know, like that would harm small cuddly kittens if we deployed it on our infrastructure. So some like very serious things that need to happen. Yeah. And that's why you can't do it. So I don't know. I just thought I'd throw that out there. It's kind of just like a different thing. I think, because yeah, I think you can drive yourself crazy really just trying to see and understand all the different things that people are building and shipping or using to ship their code. But yeah, and it's just from an organizational point of view, it gets really maddening when you're like, I really wish you're on version X of Docker this just so that I can do this thing, but you're not. And so I can't. So I don't know. Just it gets really, it becomes a very untenable problem mm-hmm. if you're trying to enforce this all over the place instead of just letting developers do what they normally would do. So.
What do you think is kind of the role of a developer infrastructure or a developer tools team then? Because on the one hand, you want to meet folks where they are and, you know, kind of see which tools they're adopting and adjust to that. But on the other hand, you know, you don't want everyone to adopt whatever tool they want because that causes organizational issues.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think, okay, this is a really important question. I mean, yeah, this really comes down to how do you want to define the, yeah, your job as a tooling engineer or really like who's, I think it's really important just up front for there to be somebody investing in the productivity of all your engineers. And mm-hmm. it's just a really important thing for organizations to do. And even if it just means we are somebody who looks at what every team is doing and then just says like, hey, there's a tool that can do generally like the 90% case to deploy code. And it's going to save you some time, but that's a starter. Like that's pretty broad. So I think to answer the question in maybe a simple way, I think that there are a few things like standardization. If there's a standardization story that's important to your organization, like meaning it is important for all of us to be using this Scratch image to build all of our Docker containers. Mm-hmm. Okay. For a security point of view. That's great. Or if it's like, we all need to be on at least this patch version of this library. Okay. Then stuff like that, like Paul, we should be building tools and processes and procedures so that that is not a monumental effort for all of our developers to engage or to go down that path for, you know, like, cause I mean, that, at the end of the day, that's not productive. You know, like we, you know, I mean, it's safe or it's what the business wants, but it doesn't help our users, you know, it doesn't deliver value to our users. So, I mean, all that stuff is a distraction. So what I think is, you know, how do you build systems, you build tools in place that allow those things to be less, to have less friction? You know, how do you just remove as many of those monumental zero sum migrations from the table up front, you know? And I think that's really what tooling is about. You know, like how do we reduce the friction for just doing your day-to-day job and ultimately give developers, you know, the ability to do more developing and not like hitting enter and waiting, you know? Like that's really what it comes down to. And that, I think that's different for every organization. You know, like there's maybe, you know, you can just look at what language are you building most of your software with, you know, and that would probably dictate a lot of what tooling works on, you know. Or it's like, hey, how often are you doing database migrations? Like maybe you shouldn't be doing them as often, but like, let's just ask ourselves, like, how often are database migrations being done? And okay. And they're probably pretty important. Okay. Well, then there's probably some tooling effort that needs to be spent on making sure those things go smoothly, you know, and just managing infrastructure maybe at some point, or maybe you just look back and you say, hey, well, these are the things that have cost the business the most in terms of outages or, you know, issues for our customers or maybe churn from our customers. And so it really affects the bottom line the most. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we want to invest our tooling efforts on, you know, and it may be a different, you know, I think it's different for every organization, but, you know, for Segment, I think really it is, we're relatively small, I think, in terms of just number of engineers still, but I do think that
how many engineers do you have?
We're over 100. I think we're around 100-ish last I checked. So yeah, just a bit less than 200. I'm far less than 200. I know. I don't think we're too much more than 100. So I think we're at a kind of an inflection point where we know we're going to grow. We're never going to get, you know, continue to grow steadily. So then it becomes like, how do we when we hire new engineers, how do we get them to be as productive as possible as soon as possible? And they can deliver value to our customers as quickly and as easily as possible. And they aren't sitting there spending their time going, hey, wait, how do I log into this machine and look at the file that's supposed to be there and isn't? And it's like, well, all right, maybe the process we have for deploying these things is not right. So maybe we should revisit that. But yeah, so I think it may be a long-winded way of answering your question, but it's very, very nuanced, I think, from every organization's point of view.
Yeah, totally. Can you talk more about that onboarding scenario? So when you hire new engineers onto your team, how do you onboard them effectively and give them the context they need to become productive as soon as possible?
Why? So you mean tooling specific?
Yeah.
Or maybe just...
Okay. Not tooling or in general, like either way.
Yeah, I think, well, in general, for anybody, a new engineer, I would hope that, you know, when you sit them down, you can, you know, give them like a, like, let's just talk two different things. Like we talk about like they're working, you know, their laptop's a different thing, or they're, you know, like they're working, let's say that that's all just like dialed into their settings and they, you know, they have access to all the systems they need to and all their SSH keys are in a good place. Fine. Okay. And so now they're in like a normal square one. Okay. So, but getting it, I guess, adjusted to the code bases and the things you, the tooling then is like, how do we reduce this to the simplest number of things as possible? Especially like when we're talking about the number of microservices, or they're just the number of things that to keep in your head. I mean, can we just narrow that down to the smallest amount as possible for me to be productive? This is, you know, like every team's going to have a different point of view, but let's just hope that it's, you know, like I understand all the services that my thing interacts with, and I understand all the different, you know, dependencies that we have. And now I need to understand different components of the code and then understand like how all these pieces of the code interact with themselves. And really, like, that might be one code base, but not all, might also be five code bases. Or, you know, like our team owns service X, service Y, and service Z. And, you know, like then it's sort of the same process for, you know, for each of those. And hopefully they're in the same kind of domain at least, so it's not crazy. And they're like maybe written in the same language at least, maybe. So you're not, you know, and they use the same patterns. And, you know, I think that kind of sets it all up, but it starts with the code. You know, like I think that it's like, you know, you sit somebody down and you say, okay, this is what our team owns. This is the source code. This is the software that we own. And so, you know, like familiarize yourself with it. Maybe, you know, try to fix a few bugs here and there, but then you go and you familiarize yourself with the tooling that this service or these services depend on. And that those tooling is probably, how do you run your tests? How do you debug your tests? How do you build your code? How does your code get deployed? You know, and those are, along with that, I would hope that it would end there, but I mean, there's also some things too that I feel like teams at Segment are pretty autonomous. Like they end up managing a lot of their own infrastructure, you know, with the asterisk meaning they lean on the managed services of AWS primarily, but you know, it does mean like, oh, I might have to install my, you know, I need to know how to install a new database schema, or I need to know like, you know, how to enable encryption at rest in my database, things like that. Or to, hey, maybe just provision a new database. That's a thing. So yeah, I think that, yeah, to summarize, it's probably starts with the code base and then, you know, goes then down the path of testing the tools used to test and then deploy, and then maybe even, you know, operate on the infrastructure. So
got it. So it starts with the source code, because that's, you know, what you're going to be working on day to day as an engineer. And then you kind of walk through the entire software development lifecycle to building, testing, and ultimately shipping.
Yeah. You know, like, I think that, so if I were to say that that's like our 100-person sort of point of view. Now, if you're in like a 1,000-person organization with even more dimensions and degrees of which that you have to have cooperation among the platforms and the tooling, then it gets a little bit more dicey. I think you just become more specialized. You like, you stop caring about how things actually get tested and you just like hope it gets tested. And that's kind of what I was kind of getting towards, which is like, you're like, okay, you know, like I don't have to write my Docker file anymore. Right. And it's like, no, you don't. Cause like if you did, you'd do it in a way that wasn't satisfactory. Like it just, you don't need to, it's pointless. Like we do these things ourselves. Actually, you know what? We don't even use Docker anymore. You didn't even know, but I don't know, something crazy like that, right? Where it becomes more and more specialized, I think, as the, the size of the org grows. But you also just need more standardization too, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you're going to provide an internal build platform for thousands of engineers, it can't be snowflakey. You know, like, it can't be like, your unicorn gets run here, and you know, all the, you know, like, you get your own special instance of Jenkins, and it's like, no, I don't want to, I don't care, just like, run make test please, and then show me the logs. Like, and just do that when I push code, please.
So, totally.
Yeah.
How big was the engineering team when you first joined the team?
I believe it was in the 70s,
okay.
70-ish. Yeah.
Okay, got it. So. And, you know, between then and now, have there been any, you know, big changes in kind of tools or kind of best practices, code-based structure, like that sort of thing, or has it been pretty stable?
I wouldn't say that, like, code-based structure and development tools necessarily, but the ways in which we deploy our code has changed, and testing our code has changed quite a bit too. So we're really hoping to do more Kubernetes based deployments soon. And I think that there are a lot of things that kind of have to change, but, you know, we're not trying to just like up in the world. There's a lot of things we're hoping to get out of the Kubernetes integration, mm-hmm. just from like an operational point of view, it becomes a lot simpler and, you know, we have better isolation stories and, you know, for our customers, like we have, you know, some efforts that are going on to, you know, create isolation at the infrastructure level for our customers, mm-hmm. you know? So, I mean, you're talking about like how data flows through Segment. I mean, a lot of companies don't want their data flowing in any of the same channels that another company is flowing into. Mm-hmm. So I think there's some really cool stories. Like, let's say you have your own Kubernetes cluster that's, you know, just that's all, it runs a miniature version of Segment just in its own little world. Mm-hmm. That would be cool. I think it's a little bit easier to tell that story with Kubernetes, and it's just easier to manage than it is with just like arbitrary Terraform things. but let's see.
How do you bridge that gap between like production and development? You know, with the big microservices landscape, obviously you're probably not going to run every single service in development. And you mentioned earlier that you have the staging environment. Is that what people rely on to kind of test things out before they you know, push things closer to prod, or is there additional support in the development environment where you try to replicate some of that?
Oh yeah, so yeah, it just depends on the service. So how do you bridge that gap between, you know, I guess, how do you reduce surprises for when you go to production? That's kind of what we're trying to get at, right? So there's different. So it depends on your services, right? I mean, the service, like, so like, let's say you have a direct dependency on some data store, and you then, you know, like, not only that, but you have like this user interaction that, you know, in order for you to test, needs all this other supplementary data, right? So you need like this big complicated data fixture. Mm-hmm. Like, there are some teams that have these very, I'd say, nuanced and complicated dependencies, and I'm just gonna leave it at that, because in my mind, like, as a tooling engineer, I want to simplify and reduce the variability of all of it. But I do, let's just say that those exist, you know, and they're very real, and they can't write specific use cases for just these very specific things. Because mm-hmm. in my world, I would just prefer that you to isolate it as much as possible, and you reduce all of the variables before you go to staging even. Mm-hmm. But let's just say that you needed to test it in staging with something very specific data. Yeah, I think that it's just, I would say that it sort of should be like a cache. You should be able to drop it and then recreate it at any time. That's kind of like a good property to have in the staging environment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'd have a way to simulate things over and over again. I think that's just another good property to have. And so if you have those two things, then cool, you can sort of have this like kind of reliable testbed. But ultimately, like, if it's not production, it's not production. So you're never going to be able to completely bridge that gap. And so that's, I kind of think that you just really have to embrace the whole incremental deployment strategy. You reduce that gap by not having a gap. how I've done it in the past at other jobs. You know, like, it gets really complicated if you always depend on, like, instead of defining your boundary just in your code very well, you instead say like, oh, I always depend on a real database connection, because it's always going to be there, right? Like, well, let's just, you know, like, if that's the way you're, you know, if you can't have very strict dependency boundaries, then then things just get really difficult to test. Or you're going to have a lot of other problems, let's say. But
makes sense.
Yeah, so, but I guess so. I think your other question was about how have things changed since I joined, just in terms of tooling and deployment. You know, I would have to say that there's two big things, really. There's the Kubernetes thing, which in my mind, like, that is just, it's like a blessing. You know, I have some qualms with some of the things that, like, EKS versus, you know, like, GCP is offering. But that said, it's making a lot of things way simpler. And then there's the Lambdas, like the serverless movement. Like, we, you know, before I joined Segment, there was folks working on our internal deployment tool, which, you know, does some things. It's very AWS specific and, you know, even like CloudFormation specific, but for better or worse, it does a good job of just deploying application code, but made no considerations whatsoever for deploying Lambdas. And so now it's like, how do we, the paradigm's there, like, you know, for it to work with, you know, what I would hope are arbitrary artifacts and delivery mechanisms, but it's actually not that simple. So, but that's, I think, the biggest things that I see right now that have changed. I mean, other things have been relatively stable. There's, you know, there's always just the tool du jour for, you know, the front end things that I don't pay attention. You know, not trying to downgrade, but I just don't keep up with, I think. So I'm sure that those things have changed quite a bit, but for the most part, I think, yeah, those are the two biggest shifts I've seen. Yeah.
Makes sense. So on the topic of Lambdas and Kubernetes, a lot of, you know, when you listen to people talk about Lambdas and also Kubernetes, one question that comes up from folks like myself who are, you know, maybe a little bit naive about the big picture is, you know, when would I use Lambda versus Kubernetes? And in your mind, is there a class of services that a Segment has that fits better into one model or the other?
You know, I think that the emergence of Lambda is really a result of things like scheduled tasks or sort of these offline processing things rather than like core services. So, I mean, in my experience, personally, what I've been using the Lambda tool for is more about like, for example, I was just deploying a Lambda recently to, you know, basically do auto scaling because there's some things within, you know, AWS lifecycle hooks and things like that that just don't offer the resolution that you need to respond to things that you might want to auto scale against. Yeah. So there's a Lambda that checks in, that wakes up every, you know, every 10 seconds and, you know, checks some metrics and then reacts or does, you know, like basically adjusts some auto scaling groups. But so I think that the scheduled tasks or the things that are super stateless and they just need to do one, they're just effectively stateless and they can just wake up and they don't need to build any sort of preconditions. They can just do one thing and they have a very discrete set of inputs. That's really what I think Lambda is good for. I think that there's a lot of things that are really become simpler from like a infrastructure point of view too. When you talk about like how do let's say you can, you know, logs get ingested. So like a new file gets dropped into an S3 bucket. Well, cool. Now I can get triggered and then just process that right away. And I can do that in number of times based on however many things get dropped in the bucket. So it's nice to decouple a lot of these infrastructure components without having to do deploy a giant queue in the middle. And so that's another thing I've seen. But
so it is kind of the rule of thumb that you apply, you know, if it's like a server like thing that always needs to be on, is fairly core, use binary deployed within Kubernetes. If it's something that's more event driven or like a one-off task, that's more of a Lambda candidate.
I think that it's pretty clear right away whether or not you know your process is like a demonizable process that needs to keep some state and like keep a connection. You know, your state might just be a database connection. It might just be, you know, it might just be like whatever, some UDP type of thing where like it has a socket of some variety, or it might even be like things in memory that is just like a big data structure to make decisions, or it's building one up over time to dedupe something, you know, stuff like that would probably would probably be way better for a just like a demonizable service than Kubernetes versus a Lambda. So, yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Let's chat about ChatOps for a bit. So
cool. Yeah.
ChatOps is kind of this idea of moving the interface for interacting with, you know, ops and infrastructure out of the traditional GUIs and CLIs that you've used to kind of introspect the state of the infrastructure, and moving more of that into these kind of like chat bots that you can interact with. Is that kind of your view of it as well, or am I leaving stuff out here?
I think that's pretty close. Yeah, I think that it's like the reality is that we're spending more and more time. We're spending just as much time in our chat client as we are within our terminals or coding environments. And so, you know, rather than go to a web page to click a button and do a thing, you might as well just like reduce the number of things you have to do those tasks within and just do it. Yeah. Keep it all there. So yeah, I think that's kind of the premise. Although, you know, I think there are some things, some workflows that are like super heavy handed when you like, they're like, you know, 12-step processes that are, you know, like, yeah, some like, do you want to onboard a new employee? You know, like, yeah, create their provision, their home directories. And like, I don't know, I'm just imagining like all these things like, nah, like, let's just like run a script for that and like check back later. Yeah. Or something. I don't know. It's just, there's things that I think maybe go a little overboard, but yeah, I think that there are really cool opportunities to just like lower the cognitive overhead or just like reduce the number of context switches in this. And there's also just a cool side effect too, where if you're doing like compliance type of things where, you know, you just need a paper trail of sorts. And, you know, as it turns out, like, yeah, going through like some change control process or whatever, it's just like, you can do it, but it's like, it's going to be a pain. And like, you can probably get by with just like messaging one little thing to a chatbot. And it's like, cool, I will record that this happened and I will automatically create a commit for you. Mm-hmm. And then I will go and, you know, that will be pushed and then triggered on all the, you know, the deployment things will take place after that or whatever. But it's like, kind of starts with a, you know, just the lowest barrier to entry in terms of communicating that to some system. So
what sort of, does Segment have a chat ops, like things internally that your team has developed and people find useful?
Yeah, we do. I think it, if I, so I'd say Segment is just like a very young in the whole chat ops world. There are some things I would say that we have chosen to experiment with, and they have been great. They've turned out pretty well. And, you know, I think that there are others, not to be named, but yeah, I mean, there are some experiments, kind of the things that I was kind of alluding to. But it doesn't end up being that useful for chat ops or whatever. It just doesn't, people don't end up actually getting a lot of value out of it. But the things we do use it for are our SEV or incident management process. So I think early on, or at least when I joined, we were using a third party tool to manage sort of our incidents. This might be like an outage or like, let's say, you know, like some services degraded. You just need some like light coordination around an ad hoc, like maybe small, medium, or large emergency. Mm-hmm. We call them SEVs. And yeah, so like it usually involves like, you know, creating a new channel and chat so that people can talk in about in a focused way. There's like, you know, somebody gets nominated as the incident commander so that they can focus on comms and just coordination. And then there's, you know, usually an engineer or two or three that are actually investigating what's going on.
Oh, that's really cool, actually. So
And so, but what's cool is that, you know, when you decide that something's happening or, you know, maybe you're being alerted in the first place and, you know, sort of lightweight discuss like, hey, everybody, this doesn't look good. Should we just call a SEV? Yeah. You just slash SEV, prompts you for three things and, you know, you hit enter and then, yeah, then you have a channel created for you. You have people being pinged along the way. You know, it's sort of like asking you for updates in a casual way. But what's also cool is once you're in a SEV, you know, you can just like SEV, you know, mitigate or, you know, you can say like escalate. Basically, you can say like, you know, it starts at a level 3, and then if it gets more and more severe or more time goes by, then you can escalate it, and it kind of becomes more and more, I guess, prominent to the powers that be. So what's cool along the way is that there's these other things that kind of get created too. So like we get, there's an incident review for all SEVs that get created that are of a certain level. And so then there's like some documentation around like a postmortem that gets created, and there's just a lot of tracking and sort of like accounting that gets created, which is great for, you know, not only reviewing and understanding how often you're having these types of SEVs, but also just categorizing them for the future so you can learn and really just prevent these things from happening ever again. So it's like the whole, you know, SRE mentality of kind of always iterating and always learning. Yeah. And like a blameless thing. But so yeah, that's one of them. We decided to build our own because we ended up being like, we just wanted something really simple. And like all the third party things came out, and like there was always something that just didn't quite fly with somebody. They were always like, well, you know, like I don't like it how it nags me, or like, you know, it always creates this document in this way, and we have no way to like customize a template, and it like assumes that we're going to do this and that, or it assumes we're going to have a postmortem for everything, and we maybe don't want a postmortem for anything except for SEV zeros, you know, stuff like that. And so we just, it ends up being pretty simple. I think, you know, shout out to Anastasia who worked on this the most, but yeah, just like coming up with a really simple solution to this and it being what I would call a super, you know, super great candidate for this chat ops thing. And I think it also came from just like, we kind of review, I think the SREs review the process pretty regularly, you know, like every 6 months or so. And like, what do you like? What do you not like? And one of the things that they came with was, I just really don't like the SEV process. Our SEV tooling needs this, this, and this. And like, I think all the SREs came together and were like, I wish it did this. I wish it did that. So we had like a bunch of information as like what the ideal tool would look like. We just needed it to exist. And so it was very well defined and well scoped. And so it just seemed like, yeah, Anastasia just like knocked out of the park. So, but I could say like, I guess I should say like there's a bit of an asterisk because I'm sure that other organizations like Stripe, who I know rely more heavily on ChatOps, kind of define this thing a little bit more differently. But like, I know, for example, like they at least used to deploy code with, you know, slash commands and things like that. And there's even, I forget the level of which GitHub, the organization, integrates ChatOps into its workflows, but you know, like the whole Hubot thing has been around for a while. Yeah. And so I think it's kind of varying levels, but we're talking like business workflows, and we're not like, there, some of them are, well, I guess a lot of them are engineering oriented, but like the other tool I was going to mention is our feature flagging tool, which I think, you know, is generally managed by engineers, but I can imagine like if you're a data scientist, you might want to like manipulate an experiment, you know, which effectively is some feature flags. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, you might have people that are not technical or not necessarily engineers working on these or working with these tools that eventually might be defined as chat ops, I guess. But yeah, so, but I guess, yeah, that's to be, maybe it's just a little nuance or comes with an asterisk like for the very pedantic people out there, but
cool.
I don't know.
Yeah. So we're kind of coming up on the end of the time here, but as kind of a final parting question, I wanted to ask you, what are some of the new tools and technologies that you're excited about that you think the rest of us should check out?
That is a fun question. Well, let's see. I've been pretty pumped about IPFS for a while. I think that, you know, I just have faith, you know, like I have faith in the whole distributed internet model. I think that's going to be cool. Mm-hmm. It's not really a tool, but it's a technology that I think is really, I think should have more attention. Mm-hmm. But in terms of tools, I really like the Knative sort of effort originally. I think it was originally called Knative. Now it's Tecton. Mm-hmm. Just the things that are going on in like the rootless Docker, mm-hmm. Docker building world. And there's a bunch of projects. Some of the, you know, my former peers at Uber done a lot of work around that. Akisu and I think, was it Kraken? I think is another one. But these are just tools like manage Docker containers and like peer-to-peer Docker registries, things like that. But yeah, like I just really think that the cloud native sort of approach to doing infrastructure and sort of just describing states that you want the world to be in, and just sort of like letting these, you know, these highly available distributed systems just take care of the rest is really a fascinating thing. And I think when you kind of go nuts with it, you could even say like, okay, let's, instead of pushing to, I don't know, a Git server, I'm going to push to my Kubernetes cluster. what does that even mean? Like, no, like it's going to speak, you know, Git over SSH. It's going to be sweet. And you're like, oh my God. So then like the code is going to be in Kubernetes, and you know, the code can get built in Kubernetes, and oh my God, like the code's going to, it's already there. Can be delivered, you know, deployed in Kubernetes. And like, it never, you just everything goes to Kubernetes. It's like everything let's just live in Kubernetes. Like, let's build our houses in Kubernetes. like let's, I don't know. It's like you can go pretty far with it, but I think yeah. it is pretty exciting to think about, like, from a developer's point of view, where, you know, you offer up, you know, some custom resource types, and, you know, like, maybe it's like a database thing that you as an infrastructure team have, you know, curated and you manage, and like different versions of it, but then you just give them a resource type and some ways in which you can configure it in a declarative way. And then you just let them throw that over the fence to your Kubernetes cluster, and then they get a database. Like, that's kind of cool. You know, that's, you know, instead of having to like file a ticket or like know anything about how distributed systems work, you really just like say, hey, I want a thing. And they just, the ticket is their request in, or their YAML that they are shoving into your Kubernetes cluster. That's pretty neat. Mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, gives a nice separation of concerns for developers versus infrastructure folks. So super excited about that.
Awesome. My guest today has been Evan Culver. Evan, thank you for being on the podcast.
Wow, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
The Sourcegraph podcast is a production of Sourcegraph, the universal code search engine, which gives you fast and expressive search over the world of code you care about. Sourcegraph also provides code navigation abilities like jump to dev and references in code review, and integrates seamlessly with your code host, whether you're working in open source or on a big, hairy enterprise code base. To learn more, visit sourcegraph.com. See you next time.